And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Connolly.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon, Phil.
Today we're going to talk to Glenn Ford. He is the founder, a founder of the really important news outlet called the BlackAgendaReport.com. And he's, by the way, going to be coming to Toronto. He's going to be speaking here on Friday, December 2nd at 7 p.m. at Sydney Smith. That's December the 2nd, Friday, 7 p.m., Sydney Smith Building, 2117. That's at 100 St. George Street in Toronto, if you know, most of you know Sydney Smith. And we'll be talking with Glenn Ford about the work of the Black Agenda Report, which has really been outstanding. And a little later in the show, probably about the halfway point, we're going to talk to Art Arbour, who is one of the Christian Peacemaker, member of the Christian Peacemaker team, CPT.org, a really important body of courageous people. These are peace veterans. We have war veterans. These are peace veterans. We value peace veterans on this program. So those are going to be our two guests. And I think, Phil, you had an announcement too.
Right. There is an event at Bates of Toon tomorrow night, which would be Tuesday, November 29th. Surprising Hidden Unknown, Canada's Role in 1947 UN Palestine Partition Plan of Palestine. It's a lecture at Bates of Toon. It is at 7 o'clock till 9 o'clock. It features a rather famous name in Canadian history, Lester Pearson. Turns out that Lester was up to other things before he was the Prime Minister and was an architect of the partition. And that's what the talk will be about.
Very important.
Tomorrow night, Bates of Toon, which is 612 Markham Street, I believe that's right.
What time?
At 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. Yeah. Great. All right. Well, Glenn Ford is with the BlackAgendaReport.com, and he is a distinguished American journalist and is one of the founders of the Black Journalist Organization in the United States. I will get it right in a moment. I think we're joined by Glenn Ford. Are you there, sir? Hello?
Yes, I'm right here.
Mr. Ford, thank you very, very much for joining us. We're really glad to be learning that you're going to be in the city Friday, and you're going to be talking at 7 p.m. at Sydney Smith Building, a very well-known site, the University of Toronto, 100 St. George Street. I just want to say, the Black Agenda Report has done, I think, a very important service in the latest crisis that developed in the Middle East with the NATO bombing the country of Libya and a bloody, ugly transfer of power there. And very early on in Black Agenda Report, it was pointed out that there was a story that was sort of driving the process, and it was the one that there were black mercenaries, it was alleged. And the mainstream media, right across the board, started this. Your site took them to task for this. Can you talk about that? Where did this story come from, and what has become of it?
Well, clearly, and we're talking about the internal politics of Libya here, that's not quite the same thing as what NATO does. But clearly, one of the motivating political strains that existed for these so-called rebels, now the government, was racism. That is, they believed that they could organize masses of people to their side of this battle if they could invoke the black bugaboo, the great black threat. And that's what they did. And the U.S. corporate media and the French media and all the European media all picked it up as received wisdom, that these were black bucks run amok, hired by Colonel Gaddafi, that's why his units were performing so well against these forces that had all of NATO as their air force. Of course, even Human Rights Watch, and Human Rights Watch was no friend of the Gaddafi regime. Even Human Rights Watch had to admit that there was absolutely no basis whatsoever the allegation that black mercenaries from sub-Saharan Africa were any substantial part of the resistance of Colonel Gaddafi's forces to the rebels. Mm-hmm. What Libya does have is a lot of black people. Depending upon what you call black, and that's a cultural kind of definition, I suppose, Libya may be one-third black, maybe more black than that. But certainly Libya has lots of folk that anybody would call black as citizens of that country. And many of them served in the armed forces because, yes, the black population did disproportionately support Gaddafi's regime, because black people are disproportionately poor in mm-hmm. Libya. And they benefited most from the very involved and sophisticated social service network that the Gaddafi government set up from the very beginning. So what they were really fighting against were, that is, when they were fighting black folks, were black Libyans. Mm-hmm. The greatest atrocity that was committed by the rebels, most of these rebels based in Misurata, was against the town of Tuwerga. Tuwerga is about 30 miles from Misurata. It was, in olden days, a center of the slave trade, and that's why so many of the people there are black. Mm-hmm. And many of the folks from Tuwerga also went to school in nearby, or took jobs also in nearby in Misurata. And they lived in segregated neighborhoods. When the siege or the battle of Misurata took place, the first task of the Misurata rebels was ethnic cleansing of the black neighborhoods of Misurata. Mm-hmm. And then they put together a brigade whose stated purpose was to purge slaves and black skin, slaves and black skin being the same thing in their lingo. And they finally, in the last stages of the conflict, marched on and captured Tuwerga and made it into a ghost town. When relief workers asked where the population, which had been about 30,000 people, was, the rebels said, oh, they've gone to Niger, or, oh, they've gone to Chad. Nobody knows where they've gone.
Well, by the way, that raises the question, and this is Glenn Ford. We're speaking to BlackAgendaReport.com, coming to the city on Friday, what has happened? Because that black community has been devastated, has it not?
It's been dispersed.
And no one's reporting. I mean, other than Black Agenda Report, I don't really find very much.
The Human Rights Watch and the other relief agencies do report on the plight of those Tuwergans and people in like situations that they find in hospitals, but no concerted effort has been made to find out what happened to the 30,000 residents. This is like the deep dark secret of the war that the Western media and many of the NGOs don't want to talk about. The racism at the core of this, and this bodes very, very ill for those rebels and their backers in NATO, because that whole tier of Northern Africa just below the Maghreb is made up of people who the people from Misurata and Benghazi would certainly consider black. And they know that there are hostile folks in charge in Libya right now. I believe that the United States, through its NATO actions, has created the conditions that could set all of the northern tier of Africa ablaze. Mm-hmm. They're going to run into a situation in which they will feel compelled to occupy, whether formally or de facto, parts of Chad and Niger and even Mauritania. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, will be very expensive and politically untenable.
Yeah. Well, you know, that ties in with another issue here that I wanted to make sure we raise, is that we seem to be having, war after war, and some, by the way, utterly unreported, violence unreported, such as the bizarre phenomenon of United Nations military force and French military force attacking the presidential palace in Ivory Coast. This is a curious situation, is it not?
I'm glad you brought that up. What has occurred? You know, are people who claim to have the interests of Africa foremost are fond of saying that AFRICOM has been a failure in that it has not been allowed to set up a formal headquarters in any African state. What they don't realize is that AFRICOM does not need a formal headquarters in any African capital. AFRICOM has already suborned most of the regional and national governments on the continent. ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, basically gave its thumbs up late in the conflict to the United Nations, French, and American assault in the Ivory Coast. That's the conflict you were talking about. Yeah. In East Africa, a regional grouping comprised of Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, Djibouti, and Somalia has given its thumbs up to the Kenyan and Ethiopian invasions, these recent invasions, of Somalia, and the transfer of 500 troops from Djibouti, which is nothing but a French colony that now is half an American colony on mm-hmm. Somalia's northern border, mm-hmm. Transfer of 500 troops from Djibouti to Mogadishu. So we have a real multiple invasion of Somalia by these U.S. proxies that has been given that has been signed off on by the regional African organization in the East, just as the Ivory Coast operation was signed off on by ECOWAS. Every year, the United States has a military exercise in Africa. People don't know this, called African Endeavor. It's an annual exercise.
Endeavor.
And their endeavors are meeting great success. In 2009, they had only the cooperation of 25 African nations. This year, over the past summer, the Endeavor exercise had the collaboration of 40 African nations. Now, what Endeavor does is it provides training on command and control mechanisms. That is the communications gear and methods that commanders use to contact and move their troops around in the field and in on water and in the air. Mm-hmm. All of these nations are using American command and control equipment, serviced by American advisors. That means that none of these African nations' militaries will be worth a damn in resisting any military action by the Americans or their allies, because they depend on the command and control systems of the Americans.
Which, by the way,
the significance of Libya. I just have to say this:
yes.
the grand significance of Libya is that this is the first time that NATO has been used as an expeditionary force. NATO has been involved, of course, for years in Afghanistan, but that's basically just aiding an already existing U.S. operation. NATO also had a piece of Iraq, but in the same kind of capacity. But this was NATO acting as a military command, an expeditionary force, and we can expect much more of the same, and most of that will occur in Africa. So now when we speak of a NATO expeditionary force, the fact that the United States has been holding command and control exercises with the militaries of 45 African countries, I think you understand the significance here.
Has a kind of a colonial / neo-colonial quality to it, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The U.S. military's advantages in holding these exercises are not just in terms of hooking these African militaries into U.S. equipment and relationships with U.S. advisors, as important as that is. But the U.S. military's strategy is a soldier-to-soldier one. That's what they call it, soldier-to-soldier. Mm-hmm. So that American generals have one-on-one relationships with African generals. American colonels have one-on-one soldier-to-soldier relationships with African colonels, and on down to majors, and even at the captain level. So AFRICOM is developing these one-to-one, soldier-to-soldier relationships with all of these African militaries. And you can understand the
fairly subversive.
Absolutely. So if they want a coup to happen, they've got relationships between AFRICOM personnel and personnel in all of these countries. And the if there's a civilian administration, well, hell, does that really matter?
We're speaking to Glenn Ford, blackagendareport.com, a wonderful site. And Glenn is going to be speaking Friday, December the 2nd, at 7 p.m., Sydney Smith Building. It's on St. George Street in Toronto. And before we let you go, I want to ask you about a theme I think that I find, that, which is a very enlightening one, at blackagendareport.com. And that is that domestic policy is foreign policy. And I'm thinking, now we have Mr. Cameron, who just recently crushed black people in London. Mr. Sarkozy has crushed people of Arab descent and African in France. U.S. is known to have exceptional number of black prisoners. And then they go abroad together, and they seem to have that domestic policy reflected there. Am I right?
Oh, it sounds like what the rednecks down south used to call a coon hunt. All the good old boys are together.
It is. It just.
And that's some black humor in both senses of the word.
Yeah, I think you got it. It is that used to be part of. I know that Malcolm X used to express that. Very important. People understand it. You don't have to look abroad to see what their policy is going to be, right? Just look at American cities.
Well, of course, you know, the difference between the United States and Europe, and maybe Canada too, is that the empire was built, the empire in the building is the United States, and so the colonial conquests, the genocidal campaign that a Great Britain would wage. All over the world, but not internally, were waged within what is now the United States. And the enslavement that Great Britain and all the European powers organized as the Great Slave Trade was an internal affair in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the very fiber of the American national personality is genocide and enslavement. But now we see with the colonies coming not home to roost, but to the colonial homeland to roost, with the great emigration to Britain and France, especially of the colored peoples of their former colonies, we see Brits and French white people beginning to act a lot more like American white people.
Yeah, that's it. That is a sad commentary, but true. Glenn Ford, we are so glad you're going to be coming to Toronto, and we thank you very much for being generous with your time today.
No, thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Look forward to seeing you.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report, and he is coming here to Toronto on Friday, December the 2nd, 7 o'clock, Sydney Smith Building. We'll be reminding you of that. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be talking to Art Arbor, Christian Peacemaker Teams, and learning about what it's like to work for peace on the West Bank.
Time is running out. Get your pledges paid before December 9th to be entered into the CIUT 89.5 FM Grand Prize Draw. Win an Urbanite 20-something bicycle from Urbane Cyclists or a two-night stay for two people at the Briars Resort on Lake Simcoe. Go to www.ciut.fm to pay your pledge or find out more information. Thank you so much for your support.
And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. By the way, we're on the net at taylor-report.com. And you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. I've had a number of interesting letters lately. I want to thank everybody. Next week we'll be talking about, there's a petition going around to alert Canadians to the danger of war with Iran, and that's something we're going to be talking about here in the future. It's obviously should be on everybody's agenda. And I'll remind you, moments ago we were talking to Glenn Ford, and he's coming on Friday, 7 o'clock, Sydney Smith Building in Toronto. And joining us now is Art Arbour of the Christian Peacemaker Teams. How are you doing there, Art?
I'm fine, Bill. How are you this afternoon?
Not bad. I'm sure glad to meet you again. You and I were at a demonstration about 3-4 years ago. They're going to University Avenue, I forget. Well, what have you to do with the situation in Palestine?
Well, you have a better memory than I do, because I'm suffering from early Alzheimer's, apparently.
Wow. Well, this will be... Maybe we could follow up with you, Art. You won't remember our conversation.
No.
You, just recently back, you were in on the West Bank doing work with the Peacemaker team, right?
Yeah, I was over there for almost 2 months.
Yeah. Now, and you are, I said before you came in, you're a veteran. I was looking at the site, which is cpt.org, and how many that work on the particular in the West Bank that started what 1995.
The team's been there since 1995, but I started only in 2001.
Yeah. And you were an educator here in Toronto. You're retired, right?
Yeah, I'm a retired school principal from the Catholic School Board. Yeah.
Wow. Hey, by the way, now part of what you do there is makes you your team accompanies children to schools, right, to make sure that they are kind of go and come back unmolested and they're secure. That's part of what you do.
Yeah, that's right. That's one of our primary aims in the work in Hebron. First, our first objective, of course, is to reduce violence in the places where we work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, for example, we only go to places like Iraq and Colombia and the West Bank and stuff like that. In the West Bank, our primary aim is to make sure that kids in Hebron who live inside the old city, a city of 200,000 Palestinians, can safely leave the old city and get to the schools which are on the other side of the checkpoints.
Mm-hmm.
So we're on the street every morning at 6:45. And we go to the checkpoints with our cameras and our videos and our cell phones and our notebooks. And we stand by those checkpoints to make sure that soldiers don't arbitrarily stop kids on their way to school, which they used to do a lot. And they still do occasionally. So we stand there and make sure that the human rights of Palestinian citizens are looked after.
Yeah. By the way, this is a great site, cpt.org. Person can go to that site, and actually there is video reports and what I saw just prior to coming here today, one in which children were at a point where they were supposed to be picked up. Somehow it involved the Israelis' forces, but they don't always pick them up or something.
We've been working for the last, since 2004. In a small village in the South Hebron Hills called Atwani. And our team used to accompany the kids to school from neighboring villages, because the only school in the neighborhood is in the village of Atwani. But there are kids from 4 or 5 other villages around who come there for school. And it was very dangerous for them, because they had to walk past an Israeli settlement. And very often they were being stoned and beaten on their way to school. So we undertook to accompany them to school in the mornings and that. And after a few of our people were severely beaten, one of our members had received a broken arm, and somebody else received another serious injury, the Israeli Supreme Court gave an order that the army should provide protection for the students coming to school. And they do that largely, but they're not very careful about being on time.
Ah.
So very often they're late, or they don't show up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fairly common. Like, that'll happen once or twice a week.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that some people have been injured and what, and to get a picture, the people doing the who are members of the Christian Peacemaker teams, they're made up of some Palestinians and some Israelis. Is that right? Or do you just cooperate with? I know that Palestinians and Israelis work with you. Are they?
Yeah, we work very closely with Israeli peace groups.
Mm-hmm.
And with Palestinian peace groups. And right now we have two Muslim members of mm-hmm. our team in Palestine. But what's important is not what happens to the people on CPT. What's important is that Palestinian citizens are being beaten on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to keep the focus on trying to keep them safe and protecting their human rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now, of course, you're doing this work with children, but there's just ordinary life there. You've also worked, I saw some footage, and again, I really recommend people go to that site, cpt.org. But someone takes, a sheep herder takes out his flock, and sometimes you have people go along with him.
Oh, yeah, we accompany people when they, we accompany the shepherds when they go out and graze their sheep on their own land. And they're sometimes accosted by settlers from nearby settlements.
Could you tell me, why would they have a, why would settlers bother them? What's the connection between their two lives?
Well, the whole goal of the settlement movement, really, is to drive Palestinians out of Palestine. That's the long and short of it. They would like them to live in Lebanon or in Syria or in Egypt,
yeah.
Anywhere.
They say as much.
Yes, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
And they brag, actually. They brag about the fact that they are the ones that control Israeli government policy, and indeed that they are the tail that wags the American dog.
They actually say
They've actually said that to me. Yeah, one settler, he actually said
so
that.
So you said, well, I'm a Canadian, so it doesn't apply to me anymore.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah, yeah. And these settlers are often from the United States, okay? Mm. They're, like in Hebron, the most extreme persons that live in Hebron are actually from Brooklyn.
Yeah, I recall, actually, the first time I heard about all this was it was American there named Wolf, and he was shot, actually. It was some kind of a struggle, but it later turned out Wolf was just a sort of a homemade Zionist. He was not actually Jewish, but he had joined a group there.
All right.
And I remember for several days people tried to figure out who was this guy, because he was known to be extremely violent. He was known for all the weapons, which is, you know, attracted attention.
Right.
By the way, what's that like physically? Are they armed, these people, the settlers?
Oh, yeah. They're armed.
Do they intimidate you?
They try. But we've been there a long time, and we live within, you know, we're surrounded by four settlement buildings, our apartment is. And we're
so neighbors.
And very often, yeah. And it's very common for us to walk out of our apartment door and be confronted by six soldiers with guns. So we're used to having men with guns around.
Hmm.
And it's very difficult for the Palestinian folk because we live right in the middle of the chicken market. And we live there because the rents, of course, were cheap there. And most of the stores are closed now
mm-hmm.
because of the history of the place. When I first started to work in 2001, it was normal in those days for groups of settlers to rampage through the old city and turn over tables of olives and cheese and eggs and chicken parts and stuff like that, and to throw Molotov cocktails inside the shops and create a lot of mayhem.
Mm.
And so people are always nervous when there are Israelis in the market, as there is every Saturday.
Uh-huh.
There's an organized tour of settlers through the market,
mm-hmm.
usually 30 or so settlers, and they're protected usually by an equal number of soldiers
mm-hmm.
as they take this tour through the market.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Art Arbor. He's a retired Toronto educator. You were a school principal
mm-hmm.
and is with the Christian Peacemaker Teams, cpt.org. They're doing really important work. I really urge people to go to the site, cpt.org. And, of course, you also if people want to join in and take and learn how to be a – it takes a lot of discipline, right, to be a peacekeeper. You have to
Well, you have to go. There is a month of training in Chicago.
You have to know how to behave yourself.
Yes, you do.
Because it's very dangerous, people with guns and people trying to intimidate.
You have to be disciplined. And there's a month of training in Chicago, usually in January, because they don't want to make it easy.
Hmm.
Okay, so they choose the coldest month, right. And because we do
they train you for the really hot area of
that's right. Yeah. Because we work in war zones where it's not comfortable. For example, our project in Colombia is in Barranca Bermeja, where it's always above 40 degrees and pretty wet.
Wow.
And it's not so. One of the first things they tell you during training is you must lower your standards, okay? Because the living conditions are not going to be comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the thing that people have to understand. So if people are interested in this work, we tend to have people who are in their 20s or over 50.
Mm-hmm.
Because when people reach the age of 30 or so, they want to settle down, get married, have some kids, and that sort of thing. So,
and after a few years of that, they're ready to join your organization.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we have a few members who did get married because they met someone on project.
Uh-huh.
Either another member of the team or someone local, and fell in love and married them and are still working in those places.
Wow.
But generally, we tend to be under 30 and over 50.
But I
recommend it for any young person who's finished university and wants to do something different before they launch on a career.
Yeah. Oh, it'd be great training.
It's a great life. You meet wonderful people, and you have really interesting experiences.
By the way, you obviously have some attention to dialogue or attempt to dialogue. No doubt there must be, you do have Israeli volunteers, but there must be some Israelis who also somewhat agree with you. I understand the settlers are not the most popular people.
Oh, no. In fact, the soldiers would rather deal with us than deal with the settlers. Because the settlers always make their life more difficult.
They can always call Washington.
Well, what they do is they call their own political leaders, and they say the army is not protecting us.
Uh-huh.
You see, so the army is always fighting those kinds of complaints.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no matter what they do, the settlers are never happy.
Well, this is Art Arbour, CPT.org, Christian Peacemaker Teams, and we have to ask you, of course, what is the atmosphere now. You've had a number of dramatic things going on while you're doing your work there. This past year, there's been all these upheavals in the Middle East. At the same time, you also had the Palestinians go before the UN to look for status. Do you see any atmospheric change where you're doing this work on the West Bank?
Well, in the first week I was there, I was asked to write a piece by someone in Chicago to explain how the people in Hebron are feeling about the application to the United Nations. So I went around and I talked to all our friends who speak English, shopkeepers, mm-hmm. social workers, teachers, a whole bunch of different people. And when you ask them, do you think the application to the United Nations will have any impact on your life or on that of your family? The unanimous answer was no. But
sorry.
But
pardon my laughing.
Yeah. No. For example, one young man said, "If joining the UN means that my family can get their house back in Haifa, which we never sold, then it will make a difference to us, okay? Because they have not forgotten the rule that people" in a war zone should be able to go back to their home after
the
war
return.
Is over. The right of return is important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but most people said that they supported strongly Abbas's attempt to get full recognition by the UN.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were not happy with Abbas's performance in office as president of the Palestinian Authority. But they still like him personally, but they thought he was an ineffective leader. But everybody supported going to the UN.
Sure.
Even though they knew that it would fail, no one thought it would pass on the first go-round, for sure. And no one expected the Americans to support it. Most people think the Americans will probably not vote in order to avoid some political problems for Obama at home.
That would almost be a victory, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
if they actually didn't vote, as opposed to using a veto?
Yeah, it might be. It might. It might.
I would call that optimism.
Yeah, yeah, sort of. It is sort of an optimistic
view. We're talking to Art Arbour, a retired Toronto educator, and he's with the Christian Peacemaker Team, cpt.org. I can't urge you enough to go to that site because there's all kinds of great information, including the article that you're referring to, that you responded to the Chicago Journal, because I remember reading the word no at the top of your article. That was
right.
The answer. By the way, you folks are truly independent because you get a little problem from almost everybody, right? The Palestinian Authority is not the easiest to work with and not the most highly regarded, I gather.
Well, they're certainly not highly regarded by the Palestinians. It doesn't really matter what we think because we don't meddle in the internal politics in Palestine. And we don't do any proselytizing about our religion either. We never talk about religion. And our single goal, our motto is we get in the way.
So that's the motto.
Yeah.
We get in the way.
We get in the way. And so what we do is it has a double meaning. It's like we move in the way in the path of Jesus, but also we get in the way between the guys with the guns and the people without. And so that's our role, is to reduce the level of violence wherever we can. So when we stand at a checkpoint, one of the things we do is we make sure that if people are arrested, we're watching closely with our cameras, and we make sure that person doesn't get beat up. And if the soldiers are too rough, we yell at them.
How about, by the way, making sure they're identified? I mean, if somebody's taken in, is that an issue? You would think it might be that... That is, who have they got, and what are they going to accuse him of?
It's hard for us to know who that is because the soldiers won't give us that.
They won't
give us that information. But usually, there's someone around watching who knows who that person is who was arrested.
Well, on your site, I read an account of something which is part of a debate here in Canada about what the policy should be regarding Israel, and that had to do with this matter of segregation. Members of the Christian Peacemaker Teams boarded a bus, which is ordinarily only boarded by Israelis, and there were some Arabs, Palestinians got aboard the bus.
That's right.
Can you tell us what happened?
So what's happened in the last couple of weeks, actually, since I left, most of this action has happened, because I left early in November. What's happened in the last few weeks is that some Palestinian activists have taken a page out of the Black Freedom Riders' history in the States, because they're not supposed to ride. There's effectively an apartheid system on the highways. If you are a Palestinian, you cannot drive your own car on an Israeli highway. And so that means that people have to take a bus, or they have to take a shared taxi in order to get around from one village to another.
Is it a question of using the road itself? Is there a second road or what?
There are some Palestinian roads that are generally not very good roads because they don't have the cash to build a lot of good roads. So we have an apartheid system that operates. But there are buses, for example, that run between Jerusalem and the settlements that are right in the middle of our downtown. Well, if Palestinians try to board those buses, they will be arrested or they will be forced off the bus. But some people in some parts of the West Bank are now taking this chance, and they're getting on the settler buses to go where they want to go.
The one I read about, that bus was pulled over, and they put it in a parking lot for an hour or so, and then eventually the army came and took the Palestinians.
They haul them off the bus. They arrest
but
them. And
do
take
some
them off
actually
the bus.
Make it? Do some successfully make the trip?
I don't know of any that have yet.
Well, they're awfully brave people, aren't they? I mean,
they're risking some imprisonment and
just to get on a bus.
For sure, they're risking arrest, for sure, and they're risking a beating too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's just a little reminder. Yes, it's an extrajudicial reminder.
Yeah, a little extrajudicial punishment. Yeah.
Yeah. What about the events that have been going on? You mentioned, or at least a site, cpt.org. Said that the use of the word spring is not used amongst the Palestinians. They don't, and I wonder, it's actually no analogy between their experiences and say somebody in Tunisia or Egypt or do they talk about these matters, or do they think it's going to have any bearing on them?
Well, they're very disappointed, for example, that President Obama, when he made a speech about all of freedom movements in the Middle East and how these brave people were fighting for their freedom, that he mentioned every group, Tunisia, the Syrians, the Libyans, the Egyptians, but he did not mention the Palestinians, who have been under an occupation by a foreign army longer than anyone else, 63 years now.
Yeah.
And so they're not expecting a lot. They don't have any hope. Really, they don't have much hope that they're going to get a lot of relief from American policy.
Mm-hmm.
What they are hoping, though, is that there will come a time when they'll be ready to grab the ring of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So, but right now they're not. They're exhausted. Like, so when I asked everyone, is there any chance of an Arab Spring in Palestine? A couple of my friends said, I hope there will be. But not now, because people are exhausted by the occupation and by the imprisonments and beatings and difficult and arrests that they all went through during the Second Intifada.
Mm-hmm.
You see. They've been through two uprisings already, right?
Yeah.
More
yeah.
than the other groups.
Yes.
So
yeah.
And those were not successful in getting them what they want.
Mm-hmm.
So right now they're sort of trying to live a normal family life, to make a dollar and to send their kids to school.
Mm-hmm.
This is what people in Hebron are telling to me is what's important to them right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the Palestinian Authority likes it that way too. They've mm-hmm. made it easier for shopkeepers to import goods cheaply from China without too much in the way of customs duties. They actually want them to forget about politics. And
yes.
And because that's in their interest,
yes.
to stay in power.
Yeah. But it is a very resilient people, though, at the same time. It's extraordinary, as you say, 63 years.
63 years, yeah.
And yet, when you, as you said at the beginning, you speak to someone about what their hopes are, and the answer was, well, if I get my house back in Haifa,
mm-hmm.
that'll be a success. Whoa, that's a very resilient person. He's thinking about going home to Haifa.
Yeah, right.
And if I understand it, also the documents that I read there, this is a really crucial part of their point of view, is that, yes, the West Bank belongs to them, and it should be, of course, it should be a Palestinian state. But those who are from what is now called Israel expect to be able to, will insist on their right to go home, as refugees are allowed to go everywhere in the world.
That's right, yeah, for sure.
Or at least that's in it. As far as I understand the Geneva Conventions, whatnot, is that anyone who's been driven from their home can return to it.
That's
and
right.
They don't have to, whether somebody induced them to leave, it doesn't really matter. It's incidental, right?
Yeah, the last time I was in a radio station was in Ramallah a couple of years ago. And we got to talking to the guys on the crew after, and we said, "Where are you from?" And you know what they said? Their first answer was, "Well, we're all refugees." Okay, like from where? They said, "Well, from Haifa, from Tel Aviv, from Jaffa." You know,
you know, that could be a great process. Meet your new neighbors. Right?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Now, as a Canadian working there. And you were there in November on the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
What was the news, or what did you know about the Gaza boat phenomena? Canadian boat, among others.
We knew as much as anyone else who can get online.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, basically. Now, the a good friend of mine who's a British doctor works in the West Bank. She's from England, and she married a couple of years ago a Greek guy who is a boat captain, and he's one of the movers and shakers of the flotilla effort in keeping getting the boats ready to travel and all that.
Mm-hmm.
She hasn't seen him for a year because the Israelis won't let him into the country.
They will not allow him.
No.
Because of that. I mean,
because of his work. Yeah.
His association with those boats.
Yeah, that's her belief anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it would certainly,
It would make sense.
Like,
yeah.
What else would come to mind?
That's right. You never had trouble before that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, does that mean, like you said, well, you could find out about it online, but word must spread, right? I mean, people hear about these boats.
Oh, yeah. The Palestinians all know about the flotillas. And they love the idea.
Yeah.
And they are grateful that people are paying attention.
Okay. It is a brilliant, very creative idea.
Yeah, one of our members was on the first boat to go in about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Her name was Anne Montgomery. She was an 80-year-old nun
from
New York City, and she got in, yeah.
Well, that probably explains the whole thing.
Yeah, she said
an 80-year-old nun from New York, you know, whatever. Yeah.
That's right. The most dangerous part, she said, was when they got into the harbor, all the kids swam out to the boat, and they thought they were going to get swamped by all the teenagers who were swimming.
So, yeah. So the authorities didn't appreciate the reception.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, now, what about Gaza? It's a sad thing, but these are Palestinians in both places. Is there any communication there? Do you yourself, for example, have you been over to Gaza?
I've been to Gaza, yeah. I was there in 2003. I was asked to accompany a Swiss journalist who did not want to go by herself. So I took her down to Rafah, which was the place where the young British man, Tom Herndl, was shot through the head by an Israeli sniper. Mm-hmm. And his parents were coming to collect him. He was in a coma in a hospital in Beersheba. Mm-hmm. And I went down to bring condolences mm-hmm. from my organization to his parents.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, Rafah is a terrible place. It's, you know, there's 250,000 people in one refugee camp.
Yeah.
And there's more, it's terribly overcrowded. But the thing is about Gaza is that if peace comes, or I should say when peace comes, it could be the next Miami Beach of the South Mediterranean. I mean, you know, because
it could be.
Lovely sunsets on the beach. There are a couple of good hotels there now.
Yeah.
And it could be a very prosperous place.
We better spread the word about that. You know, a little bit of an inducement to American and Canadians to speak up and say, hey, listen, there might be a very nice place here if you guys would just get the Israelis in.
Yeah, I got married a couple of years ago in Jerusalem, and right now I'm pushing Hebron as the honeymoon capital of the Southwest Bank. Okay, because not enough people are going there to keep the economy going.
Can I ask you, have you had any interaction with the Canadian diplomats who are in Israel? I mean, and how do they feel about Canadian peacemakers being there and what you're doing?
Not lately. Hmm. We used to get regular visits from people in the Canadian embassy in Tel Aviv, but I don't have any facts about this. But no one on the team has talked about a visit lately, for the last 3 or 4 years, and so it used to be they used to bring us beer and chocolate, which was always nice to get because you know there are no bars in Hebron, so it was always nice to get. But we haven't had any contact with the diplomats, and I'm sure that they've been told to stay away.
Well, now, what kind of diplomatic representation would there be there, by the way, in the West Bank? What kind of...
Well,
There's
an office in Ramallah.
Mm-hmm.
They don't call it a consulate, but it would probably play the same role as the consulate in most cities.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been there, actually. Because it's not easy to go to Ramallah. Even though it's 25 miles away, it's a 2.5 to 3 hour trip.
Well, tell us about that. Did you say 3 hours?
Yeah, 3 hours is what it took me. 3 hours and 15 minutes the last time I was there. And
you were dilly-dallying?
No, I was. Yeah, no, I was. I was traveling like most Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't drive your own car. You know,
yeah.
And you must take well, we travel by shared taxi because that's a cheaper way to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most efficient way to go. But because of checkpoints and because you have to go around Jerusalem, you can't travel through it. You have to go down into the Jordan Valley, then you got to come back up again, and it's quite a trip.
Wow.
It's quite a trip. And so it's one of the reasons why, for example, every Palestinian who works to their job, who travels to their job, carries a cell phone, because you never know if you're going to be stopped at a checkpoint.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I was complaining about this 3 hours and 15 minutes to my neighbor, and she said, What are you complaining about? Only 3 hours? She said it once took me 18 hours to come from Amman. Amman is like a half an hour farther than Ramallah. No, I was complaining about that same amount of time coming from Jericho.
Mm-hmm.
And Amman is really only about a half an hour from Jericho, just across the river,
mm-hmm.
just across the Jordan. And she said it once took her 18 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
So we're talking about covering 50 kilometers.
Well, what does that mean? They're just sitting in a vehicle, or they get you out and you stand around? Where is all that time?
I wish I knew. Some of it's just standing around, because if you have to change cars, the driver won't move until he's got a full vehicle, right? So you're waiting for other people to come along who are going in the same direction you're going,
mm-hmm.
you see, because gas is expensive there, much more expensive. It's twice the price that it is here.
Mm-hmm.
And yet people make an average of about $500 a month,
mm-hmm.
is the normal salary for someone, for a worker in Palestine. So, and the food's about the same price as here. So people are struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not easy to be a Palestinian living there.
I would imagine. We've interviewed people in this program about the, and I wonder, is this phenomenon still going on, the destruction of homes?
Oh, yeah.
Where does that happen? And
it happened. You know, it happened 3 days ago in a little village called Umfagra, which is very close to the village of Atwani. And we visited Umfagra very often over the last few years. You know, we're there like once a week or something like that. And the army took out the houses of two people. And now there are 18 people homeless. And they beat up the young woman who was the eldest daughter. And I just read about this today,
mm-hmm.
because it was sent to me by one of our teammates in mm-hmm. Hebron,
mm-hmm.
on the Palestine team.
Have you yourself witnessed these such things? I mean, the destruction of property?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we've been occasionally successful in stopping them, but most of the time we are not.
Mm-hmm.
And all we can do is witness, take pictures, and send it out on the net.
Stop them, or when you attempted, what do you say, that this is in violation of international law?
Of course.
And you want to know under what authority,
yeah,
et cetera.
And we often have we're often working with the Israeli groups on this.
Mm-hmm.
The Israeli Coalition Against House Demolition. A lovely guy named Jeff Halper runs that.
Ah, that's the name.
Okay,
I recall Mr.
Halper. And then there's Arik Asherman, who runs a group called the Rabbis for Human Rights.
Mm-hmm.
Arik's been arrested at least 10 times. I think he's only been taken to court once, though. I was there.
Uh-huh.
And I met Dove Marmer at the courthouse. He, you know, Dove, who used to run Holy Blossom here in Toronto.
Yeah.
But I don't think Arik has ever been jailed for his activities trying to stop the bulldozers.
They bring him in and sort of lecture him and let him go.
Yeah, they arrest him and make life a little more uncomfortable, and that's all.
Well, how did you know? This is one of the ugliest things, and I hate to say. I mean, here I am asking that question because it's sort of a fashion in reporting on what is going on in Israel and the Middle East, but I should say Middle East, the West Bank, and Gaza. But I mean, that has to be one of the more obvious violations, which everybody in the world agrees that you're not supposed to do, and
sure.
yet it just proceeds.
Yep. 170 houses have been destroyed this year.
170 homes.
Yeah. It's over 3,000, I think, in the last couple of decades.
And you yourself actually engaged them before they began to brought in the vehicles or whatever it is, the records. Who answers you, and what does he say? Or does anybody?
Well, the Army just tries to keep you away because they're the ones who are running the operation.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're there when we find out about the house that's under demolition order, if they're already there, there's nothing much we can do because they'll set up a perimeter around it, and the bulldozers will come in and they'll just take the house out. Mm-hmm. Nothing much we can do then.
Yeah. But you haven't, by the way, just since you are there and you've encouraged people to go, you've had some moments of success. That must be pretty heartening to.
Well, that's one thing about the work. You know, like when I was running a school, sometimes, you know, you don't know. You only know that your teachers seem to be happy and working hard, the kids are working hard, and maybe things are going great, okay, but you're not sure. But if you can get a family past the checkpoint when the soldier says no, then you know you've done something that day. It's measurable. You know?
Yes. So, Yeah. No, I mean, that's kind of like being a lawyer. I mean, that's you walk out of court and you say, you're free, go home.
Yeah, that's right.
We're speaking to Art Arbour, and we're running into the last moments here. Art is with the Christian Peacemaker Team, cpt.org, terrific site. And just one more time, Art, if people want to join up, how do they go about that?
Well, they should go online and go into the site, and they'll find out about the delegation trips that we take to our various projects. The first thing you do if you're considering joining us, you have to go on a delegation trip, which mm-hmm. will, you know, it'll give you an idea what the work is like. You'll live with the folks. Like for people who take a delegation to Hebron, they live with a Palestinian family for a couple of nights, and they work with the team and take part in an action and that sort of thing. And then there's a month of training in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get through that, you'll get an assignment to either Iraq or Colombia or Hebron, all those vacation spots of the world.
Well, I tell you, for me, anything would be better than Chicago, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, Alex is moaning, but
that's right.
She knows I'm kidding.
That's right. Chicago's a lovely town.
It is lovely. But it can get awfully cold.
Yes.
Yeah. Art Arbour, we're really glad you came, and thank you very much. This is Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report. Write to us, Taylor at CIET.fm. And, of course, I want to thank Phil Conlon and Alex, and we'll see you next week.